Hello, I'm Jamie Sanchez, and I want a souvenir from Earth.
I'm Lauren Fates, and I once flew and crashed my ex-husband's drone.
Are you ready for the beat?
I'm ready for the beat.
Welcome back, listeners, to the Bebop Beat. We're bringing you episode 9 today, Jamming with Edward. But before we get to that, we have one cool announcement. Lauren, are you ready to open your wallet for a new purchase?
I've opened my wallet so many times recently. What are you going to do to me now?
Right Stuff just announced new plushies, and they have chibi versions of Spike Faye and a little sausage Ein that is just so adorable.
Oh, but you already have a real-life sausage dog.
I want another.
I guess I'm into that. I haven't thought about, like, chibi anime plushies for many years. It really takes me back to a time and place in the convention scene. Just, like, a very specific type of booth in the merch hall, and we haven't seen anything like that in well over a year.
They would definitely sell myth bags, though. If you were to be there right now, you get one of those black bags with, like, that weird character you can't make out.
Or just the giant bags that are big enough to hold posters, and it's got, like, 7 brand names on the side.
Yeah.
I'm nostalgic about stuff that I didn't even like about cons. Speaking of fandom, though, we have a really cool guest that I met today back in the day when I had a geek blog. In a previous life, I had a publication called Geek Girl Chicago, and I did a lot of work with local people doing cool geek stuff. And with us today, we have my friend Terry Gant, owner of Third Coast Comics. Hey, Terry.
Hi, Terry.
Hey, Lauren. Hey, Jamie. How's it going?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
Not a problem at all. Happy to be here.
Terry, I haven't seen or heard from you in so long until I thought about you to do this podcast. How are you and how is the shop?
Okay, so this is a two-part answer, right? Like, because I'm good. Shop's good. I did make some COVID-related adjustments for the shop. But there's like a thing that I think that we have all had to do during COVID. And part of that is like, having to reevaluate not just how we do things, but also our opinions of things. And when you asked me to come on this podcast, do you remember what my answer was? What my immediate answer was?
Well, it was yes, but that you like weren't super big into Cowboy Bebop, right?
I was actually very anti-Cowboy Bebop up until, there's a thing that I love and a thing that I kind of like, I don't know. I'm not going to say I don't love, right? I love space opera. I really love space opera. Like, space opera is my jam. Captain Harlock, I'm all over Captain Harlock. Like I am so into, like, space opera. The Expanse is it's the Wire in space, right? When Lauren asked me to come on this, I was like, oh, man, I'm going to go on this podcast, and I'm going to have to say I don't like Cowboy Bebop to a bunch of Cowboy Bebop fans. But then there was something in the text of what you guys were going to talk about that changed everything. And that was that you were going to talk about a specific episode. You weren't just going to fan person out over like Cowboy Bebop in general for like 2 hours or whatever. And then that meant now I have to go back and rewatch Cowboy Bebop. I'm going to have to do that COVID thing that a lot of us had to do, where I have to go back and revisit my previously held assumptions about life in the before times. Holy crap. I now realize why I didn't like Cowboy Bebop, and now I actually like, basically got more in touch with that which I actually do love about Cowboy Bebop. I think what I didn't like about Cowboy Bebop was its ending and its shortness, right? And what I loved about Cowboy Bebop was the whole space opera-iness of it, and now I'm totally down. I hereby reverse course. Cowboy Bebop is the jam.
Welcome to the club. I'm so excited.
It was really me tempting fate, I think, because I said, Terry, are you into this? And Terry was like, nope. And given the caliber of guests that we've had on this show and who we're going to have very soon on this show, nudge, nudge, no spoilers, I was like, having a hater is going to be so great. But it sounds like you've changed your mind.
Well, so part of the problem is like, there's the things I still, you know, there's things to not like. But when I was watching that episode, and I watched this episode 3 times, right? So I wanted to get into, like, the positives more so than the negatives, because Lord knows you don't need a bunch of negatives during COVID, right? And I am more than happy to give my opinion on a thing and have the opinion be a very unpopular thing. I'm the king of unpopular opinions, right? But this show really did hit some points, like, overall, that were just solid good points. If you like sci-fi and space opera, you like, you don't need things constantly at like 99 miles an hour. It's okay if something's at 60 miles an hour sometimes, right? It's all right if you kind of like ease us into some things. And I guess my issue was when Cowboy Bebop first aired, there was like, it had a different tone to other anime that I might have been into. And I considered it kind of boring. It just bored me. There was nothing in it that I liked. And as much as I like music, right? Like, I felt like the use of the jazz kind of as like a running theme, it was sort of, I don't know, like it was weak. Like I just wasn't into it. You know what I mean? And now looking back at it, I'm like, this really does need to be like re-examined, you know? So I was willing to do it. I re-examined it.
So being such an opinionated connoisseur of media and fandoms, how does that affect the way you run your shop, or how does that affect you as a business owner?
So, So running a comic shop isn't easy, COVID or no COVID, right? And I'm not like your typical comic shop owner. I'm not really trying to run a space that's like a clubhouse for 15-year-old boys, just trying to relive power fantasies or live out power fantasies. Not really my thing. What I've always tried to do was, people say that I do a good job of like community building. I think community building is kind of a side effect of me having to curate what's on my shelves, not just for myself, but also for the kind of customer that I think I have, right? Both like in my near vicinity of the shop and also in like a broader focus of like comic book fan, yeah? So I can't use, let's say, like, one of my sayings is Batman doesn't need my help to sell comics, right? Like Wolverine doesn't need my help to sell a comic book, right? But I also can't stock a comic with all of my favorites and then try to make you love the Legion of Superheroes as much as I love the Legion of Superheroes. That doesn't work, right? But being opinionated means I can also be very discerning. And what does hit my shelf is a combination of what I think is really cool that I think you'll also like. And it's okay if you don't. I'll get a read of your taste and turn you onto the thing just to the left or the right of that.
So this might be really risky to ask, but we're revisiting Cowboy Bebop, having watched it when we were all much younger, right? We're different people now than maybe when we saw it the first time. So if you were gonna try to sell Cowboy Bebop to somebody or recommend it to somebody, who do you think would be the best person you could show it to, and what would you say to them?
Honestly, I think that now, is after things like The Mandalorian have aired, Cowboy Bebop is an easier sell than ever, right? Like, now that people are kind of comfortable with the concept of seeing a space Western, right? You don't have to do nearly as hard a sell. It occurred to me that now I think that the taste of your particular viewing audience is not just comfortable with this, but you're thirsty enough for the new content. I didn't know that Netflix was thinking of doing a new version of this, live action or not live action. I missed all that news, right? But Lauren, when you mentioned it to me in the email, I was like, oh, that's just going to be hot, right? I think that now some of the things that Cowboy Bebop is really all about just completely work for people starved for content, and starved for content that's creative and really interesting. I think when folks see, like, I don't remember in the original Cowboy Bebop if we ever see the hyper gate explosion thing that causes Earth to be uninhabitable, but you know someone's going to depict it, right? So already there's that hook. All of Spike's backstory is tragic and sad, right? There's so much happening for every major character here, and even a few of the side characters, that I think folks would be pretty drawn in. So I don't know if you have to do nearly as hard a sell. What you're going to have to guard against is, like, folks who try to compare it to something else that they've gotten very, like, I don't want to compare it to The Mandalorian. I think Mandalorian fans would like it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I do have a question for you. On the show, we've multiple times identified scenes that are pretty much full-on depictions of other media. For example, the first episode being very highly inspired by the film Desperado. And this episode in particular, obviously very strong references to Stanley Kubrick's 2001.
Yeah, HAL 9000, the second we start,
But you go on to say that this show is also very creative in its own right. Do you think modern fans will pick up on that? Because, you know, if you looked at it from a different perspective, it's kind of like the Space Jam reboot, where it's like, ha-ha, there's that reference.
What I think with modern fans, I think modern fans, for the most part, forgive me, modern fandom as a whole, when I say this thing I'm about to say, modern fans don't educate themselves enough with the roots of the work that they love to even catch how deep the new thing they're watching is digging into, right? With what Quentin Tarantino basically gave us was a license to not look at the source material, right? He said, I'm stealing from it so you don't have to watch it. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's kind of, that's the attitude he gave, right? And for what Cowboy Bebop borrows from when it's doing the borrowing, I don't think it's borrowing in that way of like, you don't have to go and look at it. I think it borrows from it in a way that says, oh my God, if like you liked it too, this is going to be great for you, right? It's not trying to pretend it's HAL 9000 kind of reference is original, right? It's very creative and going directly to the HAL 9000 thing from the jump to give you the sense, the weight of what that AI on the satellite's feeling in this episode. I was okay with that. You know, that worked for me.
We keep saying this episode, Hal. Let's get into what we're talking about formally. We are talking today about Jamming with Edward. I said it in an earlier episode of this podcast. I can't believe how long it took this series to bring in Ed. Ed is such a core part of Cowboy Bebop that I forgot that there's just so much story before we meet her. This is her intro episode. It's all about Ed, but we start with our HAL-styled satellite. The satellite is alone out in space and cuts some of these mysterious ground drawings somewhere in South America into the land.
The Nazca lines is basically what it does.
Mm-hmm. And we meet Ed. She's listening to the weather, she's browsing the internet, she's hacking, and she pulls up the Earth Gate records to search for the Bebop. She's disrupted by a rock shower, but she finds it. The Bebop is listed as the only ship in the area that's on vacation, which I thought was pretty funny. And it seemed to me like Ed already knew about the Bebop, like she was looking for them specifically. Do you guys agree?
Oh, yeah, she's the Bebop's number one fangirl. This is very obvious by, like, all of her photos posted in her space and going on to Faye about all their missed bounties that we didn't get a chance to see.
For me, I think that scene, so they drew me in with the satellite thing, right? The HAL 9000 kind of start, right? But then the fact that Ed was aware of the Bebop said to me that in-universe, there's something bigger going on than just a crew of like, you know, bounty hunter piratey dudes kind of floating through space having adventures, right? And that was another thing that I just love in some of this kind of media. So I was at that point, I was very much into where is this going? I'm in.
So just for the listeners at home who know that I'm the person who is always pausing the episode and reading things, Ed has an extraordinary amount about the Bebop up on her screen. It says that the Bebop is a fishing boat from Ganymede, reconstructed for interplanetary spaces. It has two power hands and two rocket tranchers, which I think might mean rocket launchers. It might just be a translation thing. I'm not sure what it's referring to. Spike Spiegel, Jet Black, and Faye and Ein are all logged as bounty hunters. The Swordfish 2 is called a mono racer, the Hammerhead is called a mono boat, and the Redtail is called a mono carrier. To me, the most interesting thing that was pulled up on the screen was the duration of the Bebop's journey, or how long it's been, I guess, in commission. And that was 6,935 days. And so thinking about the timeline of this show, we know Spike quote-unquote died 3 years ago, and we have to imagine that his relationship with Jet is sort of newer. So we can get sort of an estimate of how long Jet has had the Bebop, and I think that's cool.
Agreed.
One aspect that I appreciated from a technical perspective was the Bebop entering Earth's atmosphere. And it shows that, you know, these bigger vessels can and do have the appropriate shielding. We presume that they have some kind of gravity mechanics to prevent people from feeling ill or nauseous on reentry. But it does reemphasize that mono machines such as Spike's swordfish cannot enter the atmosphere or escape it very easily, which makes the fight scene at the end with MPU so exciting. You get to see Spike in this middle space of Earth's atmosphere, which we do revisit later on in the show.
What I like about some of the science behind that is it's letting you know, so clearly there's certain things that we have to consider, like there's inertial dampening, right? Like a ship that can go from Ganymede to Earth or Venus in any reasonable amount of time is moving pretty fast and it's not pulping anybody, right? But we've also established that there's only so many places you kind of want to go, right? And to go there, you've got to still be careful, you know? Like when every scene they show of the Bebop either entering an atmosphere or entering water, I couldn't figure out like why it was I love that scenery so much. And then it's the Ed scenes. Ed reminds me of a character from actually my favorite anime thing of all time. And that's the point at which I kind of had this bit of a turnaround. Like Ed's not this weird sort of annoying, quirky kid character. Ed has a specific sort of function that is hitting me in a certain place because I actually like this character. And it's because I'm a huge Gatchaman fan.
Ah.
Right? Ed is basically this show's Junpei. Right? And like you can't, when you see the Bebop like moving the way it moves like the God Phoenix moves, right? It is an all-purpose vehicle that is shielded against certain really unfortunate like realities of moving through atmospheres and other heavier liquids, right? And they have to be very careful with it because it costs money. I'm okay with all that.
Yet Jed is buying his rockets from some like discount ammunitions.
He really is. I'm gonna click this link. I know it's not like it's not Amazon Prime. It's an Amazon seller. I'm just gonna hope for the best.
Jet gets his missiles from Wish.com. So an 8 million Wulong bounty is put out for whichever hacker put these images on the side of Earth. And I want to get y'all's opinion on whether or not that's even worthy of being called a crime. Because we learned in this episode that most of the humans, if any, that still live on Earth are underground. The rock showers, the tragedy of the gate incident, there aren't really too many people out there anymore, is my understanding. And so who cares if there were some carvings? Am I missing something? Was there like more consequences?
You might be missing. So in the show, because I'm going to do a complete rewatch now that we've started, well, you guys have been doing this for a while, but like now I'm literally going to have to do a rewatch because I'm so into this now. But and I, from what I remember about the show, they don't really touch on this, but we know in our current reality, oligarchs are a thing, right? Like there are people for whom like the money gives them the power. The reason the bounty exists isn't because humans are living on the earth and like, it's human things being wrecked, destroyed, defaced, whatever. It's because someone has a sense of ownership about something that no one is using and they want to exercise, they want to flex that muscle, right? We don't see them in the show, but the only reason this becomes a quote unquote crime is whoever is making these markings doesn't own it, but I do. You know, like there's some man somewhere like really caring about this wasteland, and he doesn't like that someone draws chickens on it. You know?
I think you're absolutely right, especially because Spike eventually just says that was an excuse for them to chase a hacker. And it also seems like maybe the cops just wanted to test out their cyber tracking, cyber hunting abilities, which were very bad.
Yeah.
Ineffective.
Yeah. And the fact that Earth even has law enforcement, given that this is supposed to be such a wasteland, like they went out of their way to have a department and be equipped with a very large ship to drive around space patrols. Sure.
Right.
But yeah, the hacker hunt being an obvious thing. But otherwise, it feels like a lawless area. It's really surprising that this episode brings that to the forefront, given that other episodes that take place on Earth are just kind of like, well, I guess we're putting a big ship into space with no one's permission, and or other just really out there things that current Earth would be unable to do without the proper authority.
They literally put a bounty out on like space Banksy for defacing like uninhabited like New Mexico, you know? And it's like, why would you do that? Like, to catch the hacker who's drawing it? Man, art must be a high crime now, you know?
Faye wants that bounty. Spike is not interested. And I just thought it was a really sweet, cute moment when Faye's like, well, 8 million is easier to split two ways. And Jet's just got this attitude of like, oh, I have to work with just Faye. Okay.
Yeah.
And also a bit sexist there about just commenting about women left and right. Jet, get with the times.
Yeah.
I have noticed, I'm such a big Jet fan, and I have noticed so much more like weird Jet sexism this run through. I'm like, oh, something radicalized in me since the last time I watched this, because I'm like angry at Jet lately, and Jet is such a nice guy. He's got to change his attitude about women.
When was the first time you all watched this?
Its original airing.
Yeah, certainly when it was airing on Cartoon Network in the early, very early 2000s.
Okay, because I think when I went to the Wikipedia page, I could swear that this was originally done in the 90s. And the reason I'm asking is because back then, like, the sensibilities was nobody's watching but 15-year-old boys, right? So you use the same logic that you use when you wrote things in the 60s and 70s to sell in the 90s, right? And you don't write it any different. You don't like, you don't come at it from any other perspectives. And then you have to ask yourself, wait, we have hyperspace gates, but guys are still talking this like women kind of nonsense. You know what I mean? Like, really? We're doing that? Okay.
It was created in the 90s, and 90s Japan specifically, but we've lamented a few things about the Cowboy Bebop universe that have stuck around into the future, including last episode's terrible healthcare system. It doesn't matter what the human race achieves scientifically, it's just some stuff sticks around.
Yeah, facts.
The cops actually do track down Radical Edward. They bust in her bizarre, like, garbage and toy-filled home, and we get to see her really flex her power. She starts by flying around a little drone, and with just a few quick switch flips, she is flying around the police's spaceship, and she crashes it in a horrific fireball. I really love Ed's attitude, because she's constantly playful. She's constantly like making cute eyes and acting innocent. But she super knew what she was doing. She crashed the hell out of the cop's car.
Lauren, did you know what you were doing when you crashed a drone?
No, so I can tell that story. I bought a really nice birthday gift for my ex-husband back in the day, and it was an Air Hogs USS Enterprise.
Whoa.
Quadcopter drone, very cool.
Sounds cool.
And the problem with a fandom, like, gimmicky piece like that, if you get a real, like, a good drone, they make replacement parts, and crashing it and breaking it is not a big deal, because when you fly model planes or you fly drones, rebuilding it and repairing it, like, that's a thing, that's part of the hobby. But this Air Hogs Enterprise, this Star Trek memorabilia, I just don't think it was actually meant to be played with, let alone indoors. And I don't know, I think he was being sweet and he just really wanted me to try it. And not only did I crash it and break the propellers and ruin it, but I crashed it into our custom Lego Serenity and destroyed that too.
That's a twofer.
I think you're my hero.
I have a history. My mother's car also goes in this category of people around me believing in me and encouraging me to try things and then me crashing them because I wasn't actually ready.
So I want you to know, Lauren, I have a list of enemies and a lot of encouragement for you.
Great.
I've got some ideas.
Radical Edward style. I'm just going to go plowing in there with a smile on my face.
Perfect. Perfect. I think that's great. I have a question for you. since I've watched this episode several times, I just caught a thing on my third rewatch that I don't think I really noticed the first couple of times. And I could be wrong about this. You guys would know more than me because you have absolutely, like, you know, you're really into this show and I'm just coming back to it. Radical Edward doesn't just fly a little drone around before the cops come. Radical Edward, I think, is flying around a drone version of the Bebop.
Yes, she is, that
she built.
Right. So she's flying the Bebop because she knows damn well her destiny is the Bebop. The cops show up they basically just invade her playtime, is what they do, right? When the cops come in, they're kicking the door. Radical Edward, we know you're in it. Radical Edward was like, yo, son, I was on something right there. Oh, but you're not leaving. Okie dokie. You're going to have to walk home now. You know what I mean? Like, that was cool. I was all right with that.
I like what you're saying there, because I think you could really say that's Ed sort of doing a proof of concept. We know, spoiler alert, yeah, she flies the Bebop at the end of this episode. Right. And so maybe this was literally her saying, wow, I get to conveniently check now if this technology will work on a real ship. Thanks for bringing it to me. And maybe that's why she let herself get caught in the first place.
Absolutely. This show works on multiple levels.
I would argue that her level of fangirl for the Bebop means that she's just had this little Bebop drone around because she adores it so much. Why she hadn't considered a way to place a bounty on someone to get the Bebop to Earth earlier than what we witness here in this episode is beyond me, because it's very clear her intent to join the Bebop.
You know what it might be like? It might be like you have your, I don't know what your favorite bands are, but like my favorite band is Dream Theater. And I will see Dream Theater when they come to Chicago, provided the cost is less than X. That's like my one rule, right? The cost has to be less than X. I will not, however, drive to Milwaukee to see Dream Theater. I will not drive to Indianapolis to see Dream Theater. I'm not driving to Cincinnati to see Dream Theater. I'm naming these cities because I've driven to those places for other things, but not to see my favorite band. So maybe, like, you know, Radical Edward is watching the Bebop's movements, like, is the Bebop coming to my town? Hot damn, the Bebop's coming to my town, right?
And like, when they do, they're on vacation?
Yes. Like, the vacation part was a weird line.
When can they afford a vacation? They're so bad at bounty hunting.
I think that's that translation between what's in the original Japanese and like what's in the translation for us. You know, they probably really were coming to Earth to be like, well, let's just check it out. Let's go to Earth. There's nobody there.
Nobody comes from Earth.
No one's there. It's great. Let's totally go. Let's do that thing.
We got a letter from our listener Wah a while back about the differences between the dub and the sub, but also the differences between the sub translation that we have and what is actually being said in Japanese. And it really opened my eyes, thank you, Wah, to the fact that the translation is still just an attempt, and it's not even always exactly what is being said in the language. And so our comparisons, I just want to give the disclaimer, are between the dub and a translation. None of us speak Japanese, but maybe I can share some of that stuff from Wah on our social media. But anyway, this is my transition into saying one of the weirdest differences between the dub and the sub translation, to me, happens when Jet is walking around interrogating people trying to get information about Radical Edward. Most of it's the same. It's a child. No, it's a beautiful woman. No, it's this giant basketball player. But the dub says cross-dresser when the sub-translation says gay. And the idea that the translation would say homosexual and be dubbed into cross-dressing, I think, is really indicative of the time this was released and what they thought they could say or portray on television. That's my take on it. Like, a cross-dresser is quote-unquote funny and can be, like, a joke to late 90s, early 2000s kids. I can't remember in that era anything being called gay on television.
Yeah, I found that very strange in my watch through of the sub this time. This was my first watch through of the sub, to clarify, but I did want to add a little bit more context because I didn't look into the part where you referenced cross-dressing in Japanese, usually shonen media, there are references to characters known as okama. And okama are traditionally portrayed as drag queens, and they are typically used for plot as comedy, comedic relief. The most prominent okama I could probably refer you to is that of one of the characters in Tokyo Godfathers. And I believe the character was very well portrayed in the film. I do find it very unfortunate when shows like One Piece or this one in particular makes reference to okama or, you know, just that comedic effect. It doesn't land anymore. It just needs to go.
But really what you're saying is it's neither. Like, the word itself culturally is neither drag queen nor homosexual. It's like its own word that maybe there's not a direct comparison for in English. So they're just trying their best and maybe making it worse.
Yeah, that seems likely. I haven't necessarily looked up the etymology of okama in a very long time. But in general, when anime shows use this kind of reference language, it's typically for a comedic effect. It never lands with me. It can just be written right out.
This actually reminds me of another Gatchaman thing. And Gatchaman is like a mid-70s anime, right? And the main villain for seasons one and two, even though season one is thought to have like basically like, I don't know, 50, 70 episodes or something like that. Like, the difference is that in the main villain for that show appears to you, the viewer, to clearly be like a woman in like hip high boots and lipstick, lip gloss, et cetera, et cetera. The voice is a harsher, like a deeper kind of male coded voice, right? But the main characters in the show, the main heroes, every time they run across this character, they read the character as male still, right? They read the character as male still because the character is just a villain to them, and everyone in the show practically is male unless absolutely coded female, you know? But at some point, I just remember, at some point in the show, you get into the backgrounds of the villains for both seasons one and two, who both have this, they're in the same kind of similar situation. And you know clearly as the viewer, this person is female, but they can't see it. There's no comic relief layer there, right? They don't do that. But it's because it's like there's so many episodes and the way that this show and shows like it were done back then, a lot of the heroes winning has to do with the incompetence of the villain, right? So later on, we translate that into incompetence. By the time we get into like 80s and 90s kind of things, we see that as comic relief. But back then it was if the villains couldn't get out of their own way, the heroes are going to win. You know what I mean? So it's some of that. There's using androgyny as other and weird. And then because of the androgyny, the heroes have a leg up. It's kind of a lot of what I'm seeing, you know?
That's really fascinating that you mentioned that. I recently watched Gatchaman Crowds, which is a sequel, technically, of Gatchaman. That was like my first foray into this universe. And two characters are androgynous. And
yes.
It was not made for comedic relief. It actually enhanced some of the characters' perspectives. And it was just, I found it very refreshing.
It really built on what the original Gatchaman was trying to do and kind of pretty much got it right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say so. And then the other aspect to that show in particular, season one, I've heard is, and which is what I watched, is very good and comprehensive. And it actually has a lot of interesting thoughts and theories on like modern media and social media and what it means to be a hero. I've heard season two stay away from, so I haven't had a chance to watch it. But in general, the villain's pretty terrifying. You know, they also have a really good production value. So if, hey, listeners, pick up Gatchaman Crowds. This is me plugging it because it was a fun watch.
I lost my mind over the news Gatchaman Crowds was a thing and then making sure I could watch Gatchaman Crowds. I watched it and I really had to break myself out of my like my thinking cage of wanting it to be like original Gatchaman, more references to original Gatchaman, but it worked. It works better for me as a fan of like My Hero Academia, mm-hmm. right? It works better for me thinking of that show for this show, but the characterization and the layers, I think they did a really good job. I've also not seen season two, but now I think I'm going to have to watch it.
Well, I'm glad to hear it has your endorsement.
Yeah. Lauren, I like this Jamie Sanchez. You should bring her around more often.
I hang out with her pretty frequently, you might have noticed. So I've already gotten that impression. Thank you for the permission. Earth and this interrogation scene is also what introduces us to Piyoko's. And I went absolutely nuts looking at Piyoko's because I thought they were chocolate. And they fed one to Ayn. And I was like, no, don't give the dog chocolate. No. And so I went to Google and was like, please, Google, make it okay. And Google did. Apparently, these are inspired by Hiyoko's, which are a Japanese snack. And that is cake-based. It is not chocolate-based.
It just happens to be brown.
So I guess Ayn can have one. Yeah. Well, in real life, they're lighter. But the brown coloring, it sure does make me think chocolate. But I don't think Jet would allow Ayn to eat chocolate. No. He's been pretty good to Ayn.
Yeah, so Hiyoko manju are a common omiyage or souvenir, as it's called in Japan. So the fact that Hiyoko's make an appearance as a Piyoko and that Earth doesn't produce anything good might be commentary on that, but also maybe commentary on Peeps. Just going to put that out there.
Are they made from like plum or rib meat? Like, I'm trying to think of things that could be dark. That could be that a dog would be like, yeah, let me eat it. You know what I mean? Like a dog will eat anything you put near its mouth where there should or shouldn't, you know?
I was going to say, it doesn't have to be appealing for the dog to want it. It could be dirt and my dog would eat it. Do we think nothing good actually comes from Earth, or do we think that's just a mean thing that Jet says?
That's like saying Indiana's just this vast wasteland.
Well,
if you're from Chicago, like, that's so mean.
Please don't look back at anything I may have ever said on Twitter about the state of Indiana.
So Ed figures out that there was no human hacker. The satellite has a personality inside of it that is named MPU. It is a secret sort of spy attack satellite that I think was disguised as a weather satellite. And it's just still sentient and it's floating out there really lonely. So Ed decides she's going to hatch this plan and download MPU to be her friend forever, but then let the bounty hunters turn in a copy to the police, which in and of itself reminds me a little bit of like The Prestige, because like The Prestige there's a twin and one gets drowned every day. Like, this AI is going to get turned into the cops and live a terrible life. But okay.
That is a perfect analogy. Because ethically, it's also like, wow, you're really going to let a version of this AI get caught. That's so sad.
It kind of works if you think about maybe the AI is so young in its development, it doesn't realize its twin is going to have to just kind of be in stir. But up until this point, to the AI, there's been nothing but it and the lines it draws, right? So all Ed has to really say to it is, you're going to be free. You come with us. We're going to trick the bad men, right? And if you approach it from the standpoint of like what like a toddler might reason, this can be fine, right? But maybe when Ed is like, you know, 19, 20 years old, Ed's going to have to rethink this and go, ooh, man, I wonder how that incarcerated MPU's been all this time. And then going to have to go and like, you know, go listen to all of its rap records and like, you know, its spoken word. And yeah, look, it's a bad scene when you go back to make right for this, you know.
So quick question. Do you know where MPU gets downloaded to? What are your best guesses?
My best guess when MPU gets downloaded, basically just having to watch the things that Ed carried with Ed, I'm guessing that something the size of like a 1980s tape recorder or a CNC toy or Easy Bake Oven would be the perfect size for like MPU to live in for a hot minute until they get around to doing what every space opera show does and puts MPU into the Bebop itself.
It's funny that you say that because my assumption was that MPU is just in her computer. Like, she just has such a powerful laptop that she carries around with her that there's plenty of storage for MPU. But I couldn't remember, like, if MPU came back, sort of how, like, Jarvis in Iron Man's suit is around for a really long time, eventually gets to become the Vision. I'm like, maybe something cool happens with MPU, and I don't remember. No, MPU is never mentioned ever again. And so another thing it reminds me of, I'm just pulling out the references left and right today, is the movie Solo, in which we learn there is a female, like, bot rights activist robot AI that is put in the Millennium Falcon and is apparently there through the entire Skywalker saga, and it's treated like such a sweet thing. She gets to live on in the Millennium Falcon, never acknowledged or talked to for generations beyond today. And I think something like that happened to MPU.
Possibly. So to roll back with the original question about where did MPU go, I would like to make a reference to Ghost in the Shell Standalone Complex Season 2, where the sentient cyborg wants to fuse his consciousness with the internet. And I think that's what happened to MPU. MPU now lives in the ocean of fish ether that is the net.
I immediately thought of one of those, like, Tachikoma. MPU just being in, like, a Tachikoma, just kind of cruising around L.A., you know? Hey, look, it was cool when I was just drawing, like, sheep and dogs on New Mexico, but now I can actually explore New Mexico. How cool is this? That's all right. Clearly, the Bebop needs a Tachikoma.
It does. Why don't we have this? I guess because you can't buy it on Wish.com.
That's not paying for a Tachikoma. Cheap bastard.
He's got to keep paying for little bonsai trees that he keeps butchering. He takes out another one in this episode.
Woof.
Yeah.
Because he's not very good at his hobby. Poor guy.
He's trying to impart some calm or wellness, and he's just not... He's never in that state to perfect his bonsai grooming abilities.
Jet is a metaphor for bosses everywhere, where like there's the thing that you need in order to get this job done is just stuff you need, but you can't have that stuff because the boss is sitting in an office somewhere with a tiny little toy that doesn't relate to you at all, that means nothing to you in your existence, but that's where all their focus is. And it requires the cash right now.
So Spike finally decides he's interested when some action is put on the table, like actual action, flying spaceship, shooty shoot action.
Death Wish action is what I'm hearing.
Yes. And the twist or the challenge is that in order to get to MPU, we have to turn our ship's computers off, because if the computers are on, all of the satellites in the sector will fire and just absolutely murder Spike or whoever triggers it. This does happen, by the way.
Instantly.
Maybe that's why there's a bounty out, because there's a death trap of lasers floating around in orbit.
I think that, like, earlier in this episode, well, in the episode of this podcast, it's mentioned that maybe this isn't really a weather satellite. It's more of a spy satellite that no one wants to call a spy satellite. Because there are an awful lot of laser-enabled things protecting this, like, you know, weather satellite. And when you think about it as just like Banksy in space, you don't consider that it's using lasers powerful enough to dig into the earth. But if you ever watched Justice League Unlimited, right? They get in a lot of trouble for having like a laser beam thingy in orbit above the earth that can carve up like Arizona, right? This thing had like seven or eight of those. So yeah, I think that, okay, we're going to cruise in there on some like just compressed air power is probably the best idea you could possibly have. Except it's alive, so it knows you're coming. It can see you. You know, it doesn't have to detect your computer. You're moving towards it. Nothing else moves towards it ever.
And then somehow Spike is also able to evade dozens of space laser-enabled satellites that have a 2% margin of error.
Yeah, now we're at comic book physics.
It's a really cool-looking scene, though, you guys. It's really cool-looking.
It was cool-looking.
And that's why they did it.
If you're ever wondering why something exists in the Cowboy Bebop universe, it's because it looked or sounded cool at some point in time. That is literally the differentiating solution for the director. It's like, how cool is this?
The sausage is delicious. Don't ask how it's made.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I will give props to a couple of things in this episode that went kind of undetected in previous watch-throughs. One, when the broadcasts are happening, one states that this episode's broadcasted in 12 languages, which goes to further emphasize the multicultural aspects of the solar system and the broadcasting ranges. Another cool thing I noticed was that the opening scene that announced rock showers, the radio cast there, was very much like weather forecasting radio stations that announced like, oh, wind at 12 knots from northwest.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I grew up around a harbor, so like that's very deep in my bones. It resonated with me this watch through.
It's very AM radio.
Yeah.
Before people at me for coming at jet sexism, I do want to sort of hat in hand admit that Faye is really at her worst this episode as well. I'm a huge Faye fan, but she says hackers are nerdy, pasty, tubby little geeks with triple thick glasses. They are otaku with stinky feet. And not only does she stereotype computer fans in that way, but she super tries to abandon Ed. In the Japanese, she goes so far as to refer to herself as One-san, like, I'm your big sister, come on, like, let's be friends, give me the bounty. She really just develops that rapport with Ed and super tries to screw her. She says, some promises are meant to be broken. In fact, most of them are. She's just a huge jerk, so
yeah.
It's not just Jet, is all I wanted to say.
We also get a brief foreshadowing that her age might actually be older than we think it is. I appreciate that the show keeps plopping these little hints throughout, just very, very minor pieces of dialogue.
The show also continues to basically ignore Ayn and give him like a moment of high tech Zeta Dog, like wink, wink, nudge, nudge, but then he's not part of the plot. He's definitely sitting like on the computer at one point watching the screen while Spike washes his ship. So he's just a background accessory, like, look at that smart dog. But that's all.
There's also the scene where Ed, her big yellow hacking happy face, appears on the screen and Ayn's just kind of sniffing at it and very inquisitive. And as soon as it makes a grimacing noise, he gets scared and runs away. And it's very indicative of like corgis. It's like, I'm curious about thing. And no, now I'm scared. I'm going to run away.
And that whole like that sort of the way that Ed's hacking is represented to remind me very much of the Galaxy Rangers. Right. So it was one more thing that like endeared itself to me where like, we're not going to get into like the technology and the science of how hackers hack or any of that. We want to make it just enough like magic, but not so that you can be drawn in by it, right? And it's Ed poking around on the Bebop. It's Ayn noticing it and interacting, and it's Ed immediately interacting back. So Ed can see onto the Bebop in that moment, right? And I thought that was kind of clever. I didn't mind that at all, which means that when did you notice at the end, when Ed shows up, Ed references Ayn, right? Ed knows what Ayn is. And at that point, it's not just like, oh, wait, you guys have a dog, right? That the dog was named by Ed. And I thought, all right, that works for me. I'm good.
That actually makes their relationship throughout the show even more endearing. The fact that Ayn is Ed's first contact makes a lot of sense, and I'm glad they planted that seed.
Yeah, agreed.
This episode also is like aliens? Maybe they're aliens. And I'm glad it went there just to discount the fact that no, there are no aliens in this entire series.
Aliens could have done it.
Conspiracy is alive and well, but.
Right. Why not aliens? We can travel all over the galaxy. Why can't aliens come here and do art? What's wrong with that? It's good stuff.
We do have some production notes for you today. The animation director for this episode is Takahiro Kawamori, who was also involved in six other episodes, including Puro LeFou and also the Cowboy Bebop movie. Takahiro Kawamori has worked on lots of Gundam, no surprise, My Hero Academia, and was the key animator for Jinro. Also featured in this episode was Cats on Mars, which I just think is really adorable track. You know, that tends to be Ed's theme song, and it's bouncy and springy and adorable, just like she is.
One thing I was inspired to look up was when drones were actually first created. And the first one was created in the 1930s, which was much, much earlier than I imagined. And that's pretty rad. A funny thing that I noticed was Big Shot is actually in this episode, our bounty hunting TV show. And at the end, we actually didn't really reveal how the episode ended. They don't get the bounty because the police decide that a bounty must be a organic life form, and that is not what a computer is, so they're broke. This gets announced on Big Shot, and I just want you to go and watch this animation. It's bizarre as heck. A little cow on a stick is shoved onto the screen to, like, deliver the message to Punch, and then the cow falls off the stick and bounces off the screen, and it's like a low-budget public access TV show production error. But this is an animated cartoon. Like, that was a choice someone had to draw in, and I'm just in love with that detail.
I was very delighted by that scene. That, like, barely three-second moment.
Just to also show you how broke our heroes are going to be, right? Like, the show that announces or that keeps tabs on what people are making and how they're doing it is also going to be broke this time.
You know? Yeah. I don't think we can upkeep our podcast bounty count anymore. I think we have to officially kill it, because not only in the Picaro catch did we not really know how many they caught, but now we know they're missing them off screen. We're not getting their full history. The count can't possibly be accurate.
Oh, well. I mean, it was fun while it lasted, but that's not the last of our fuck-ups down the road. There will be many other miss bounties, if that's what you were hoping for.
Edward's full name, I want to make sure we say it out loud, is Edward Wonghao Pepelu Tivruski IV. At least in the dub, she says she gave it to herself, but I think we're going to learn more about that later. And finally, one more difference that I noticed between the Japanese and the American is how much weirder the line is where Faye discovers that Ed is a girl. So in the dub, Ed laughs this, like, delighted child playful laughter. And in the sub, she does this creepy, like, laugh as if she is very intentionally deceiving people and knows the weird effect it has on people that she is androgynous. And I like self-aware Ed a whole lot.
Both my partner and myself recognized how similar the casting was between the sub and the dub, and we really appreciated that that voice retained a lot of its similar characteristics when it was dubbed.
I think my cool factor this episode, the thing that stood out for me that I'm really going to remember, is the design of Ed's sort of hacking world. The way they portray the internet and her ability to dive through it, it's just a very weird place. There's like whales, narwhals floating by. And I think now more than ever, I just appreciate, like, yeah, the internet did get real weird.
I appreciate the absence of Twitter and blue check marks during Ed's net diving, since I've been tracking Cowboy Bebop news through hashtag searches. And today in Weird Shit, AstroMonkey1 tweets, "I've always said life was like a treadmill. You run as hard as you can, as fast as you can. The view never changes. And when you're done, you're exhausted and you haven't gotten anywhere." Social media manager Paul from Planet Fitness responds, "That's some real Cowboy Bebop level existentialism there, fam. And like, what is the world? I really don't understand."
Wow.
So was this first person even trying to get in touch with Planet Fitness, or does Planet Fitness have social listening just around the idea of treadmills?
This is in response to a tweet from Planet Fitness. Who knows if AstroMonkey1 is actually into Cowboy Bebop, but shout out to Paul for bringing it home.
Great. I found that the way that the internet and hacking was represented here to be more indicative of like kind of classic cyberpunk writing, right? The way like William Gibson would reference things, or like even early, for sure, Neal Stephenson, Snow Crash, right? The way that the internet is represented there is visual with like sort of definitely like visual, like objects that are almost like, it's almost like the recreated world. Right now we know it's ones and zeros and, you know, pathways to this thing, the pathways to this thing, and a language to translate it all, right? But back then, what the internet was imagined to be had a lot more to do with like what your video games and Switch environments are like, right? Like it has more to do with like, back then it would have been thought like, you're going to log onto the internet. All right, well, my internet looks like Skyrim. Well, my internet looks like Animal Crossing New Horizons. My internet looks like Doom. My internet looks like The Sims, right? Like, that's the way it was always portrayed back into like the 80s. When we get to the internet, it's going to be whatever we want. And always very visual and very clean and distinct and clear to the user, right? Ed's moving past all these signs and icons and large data points, but towards something that looks like the way ganglia is depicted in your brain, right? So the AI is clearly the like nerve ending ganglia having thing at the center of it, but all these like billboards flying past are things Ed's gonna have to ignore to get to that thing, you know? And I felt like that was of the time.
You're really making me think about where Cowboy Bebop was made, you know, the late 90s, and what technology was then, and what has to change, or at least be considered in the Netflix live action version. They're going to have to be really clear about where they exist in time, and when, and, you know, when this is set in terms of technological advancement, because there was no such thing as social media. I wouldn't even say cell phones were all that pervasive when this anime was made. They're going to have to make a choice with the new one about how much of that stuff exists.
There's actually a larger discussion around this kind of thinking and design work in graphic design and UI design circles. There's a book called Make It So, Interaction Design Lessons from Science Fiction. Any design nerds or UI nerds who want to check it out, I recommend you do so. It's just a really interesting account of how did Star Trek design UI, given, you know, set design at the time? How do we represent affordance when it comes to interfaces in modern media? And more recently, we're seeing shows like Yuru Camp and Gatchaman Crowds portraying social media and the use of technology and cell phones in a much more cleaner and elegant and sophisticated way. And I love it. I love how seamless it's becoming. And I think what gives Bebop the edge is it relies more on analog stuff. It's not pretending to be that bright, glossy thing, even though it does have those interesting elements of the tech future. But it's very much a product of its time. You know, that is definitely what the 90s web looked like to people.
And you know what's going to happen is, like, all of this that we're saying, we think we have our finger on it, and they're going to take a shortcut. It's going to be Millie Bobby Brown cast as Ed, and there's going to be a little port in the back of Millie Bobby Brown's head that they're going to plug right into. We're going to full Matrix from that point on. Like, the money will be spent on Ed's play environments, right? But then everything that Jet and Spike have to do and Faye have to do to deal with that ship, it's going to be like basically, you know, like a flying 1980s kind of battleship or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it won't be snazzy. It won't be that Star Trek The Next Generation Art Deco kind of clean plates and faces on things. It's going to be gritty, grimy, wet, and messy, right? We're going to be able to smell it from Netflix, you know what I mean? But when it's Ed, it's going to be like, jack yourself on it and get in that internet and play with those cartoons, right? That's what they're going
to
do.
I'm looking forward to that. I want a VR perspective or an AR.
I can live with it.
Yeah. I'm here for that kind of stuff. That makes perfect sense, too, for a Netflix tie-in with a VR or an AR game.
Yeah.
Well, I'm super grateful for the internet because it allowed us to reunite with Terry and hang out with him and talk about Cowboy Bebop. Terry, if our listeners wanted to hear more about you, know what you're up to, I know you got some podcasts. I know you got the store. Tell us about what you're up to.
Okay. So, as we mentioned at the top of the show, I own Third Coast Comics, which is at 6443 North Sheridan Road in Chicago. So right on Loyola University's campus by the Loyola Red Line Station. During COVID, for the most part, I'm only able to have like two people in the shop at a time, but we've been doing a lot of mail order this past year. I don't even have an e-commerce site. People just email me at terry@thirdcoastcomics.com, all spelled out. And then just tell me kind of what you're into. You don't need to ask for like specific things. You could if you want to, but if you just want to give me like an array of the kind of things you like at a budget, I will match your taste to your budget and send you a box of graphic novels that you're just going to love. That's kind of, I've been like personal shopper to like the nerds for like the past year. And it's been awesome kind of being able to like figure out new ways to do that. I get turned on to new books that way. And I turn my customers on to new books that way. My podcasts such as they are Stakes is High, the Black Nerd podcast that I do with my podcast partner, Troy Hunter. You can find that basically wherever most podcasts can be found. There are apparently, however, two Stakes is High podcasts. We're the other one. I have a baseball podcast called Drop Third Strike, because in addition to being a professional wrestling, progressive metal, and comic book nerd, I'm also a huge baseball nerd. And me and my podcast partner, Beth Davy-Stofka, last year started a baseball podcast just to track how that sporting industry would be dealing with COVID-19 over a 60-game season. And we just picked it up again just this week for the actual regular season of baseball. And that's on YouTube. And it's called Drop Third Strike. And I have a YouTube series of basically nerdy things called Doomsday Clerk, which is on my own Doc Midnight. So Doc Midnight is my Twitter. And I also have Third Coast Comics is my Twitter. So 3RD Coast Comics or Doc Midnight, DocMidnight. But if you go to YouTube and you look up Doc Midnight, you'll find me. And under me and the things that I am doing, one of them is Doomsday Clerk, a Third Coast Comics blog where I kind of just turn people on to new and interesting things that have come into the shop. I would love to have a channel called Doomsday Clerk, but I don't know enough about how to get this shit done in order to make all of that nice and easy for me. I just tend to like try to do a thing and I just plug it in and let's go. And then I realize after I'm 5 episodes, then I've been doing it wrong. And then I just stick with it. So that's kind of where we're at.
Dang, you're busy. How do you keep up with baseball and everything?
A lot of it has to do with like, just I carve out my time in the like, the things that I like, I will afford more time to. I'm a fantasy baseball player, and mostly not because, like, I get that people will say baseball is boring to watch. I will agree with you. It is boring to watch. But if you get into the tracking of the statistics of baseball, the numbers behind it, then suddenly you start loving the people who do it. Right. And I think that's kind of how that worked for me.
I can respect that. That's awesome.
When you announce like the technical details for this episode, I totally thought to myself, that's fantasy baseball, but for anime. Right. Like, I know I see the credits go by, right? But I could not have told you someone working on this show is also working on My Hero Academia. And that makes that extra cool for me, right? And fantasy baseball works the exact same way. And like, the history of comics works that way. The history of pro wrestling and heavy metal works that way, right? So I kind of get that thing. Yeah, I try to find ways to indulge all of my nerd interests however I can. And the way I just find time to do it is if somebody like Lauren contacts me and says, hey, would you want to come on and do this thing? Or hey, you want to try a project? Usually my first answer is nope. But then after like 5 minutes, I'm like, yeah, let's do it.
Well, I'm extremely flattered because you said early in that rant there that you make time for stuff you like. And so maybe you like us. Maybe you like hanging out with us.
People. So there's also my friends, right? Like Lauren, you were talking earlier on about how we met, right? And I didn't remember that part. I remembered us having like mutual friends and that you were always a super nice nerd person, right? And in the circles that we traveled, sometimes you find people and you're like, I thought you were cool, but I got to back away now, right? And then sometimes there's people who are like, nah, they're always dope. All right. Yeah, sure. I don't talk to them all the time, but if they're asking, I got to figure out a way to make that happen, right? And that works for you. You know, that's where you are. You're at the holy shit. All right. That's cool. Let's go. Let's do this thing.
That's awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah. And I feel that way about you, too. That's why even though we hadn't talked in a long time, I was like, I know who I got to get on this show. One thing I appreciate about our show in general, I don't know how much I should say, but we really like to alternate back and forth between fan guests who just like to hang out with us and chat fandom, and then people who actually for real worked on the property, anime. And I'm not going to say it yet. Y'all just got to wait. But next week for Ganymede Elegy, we are going to blow your minds. And so we'll sign off there, and we hope you get so excited for things to come.
They found the Jim Steranko of anime comic book nerds. Tune in. Don't miss it.
Thank you for listening to the Bebop Beat. If you like our show, please rate us on Apple or wherever you find your podcasts. Find us on Instagram and Twitter at BebopBeat. Our email address is BebopBeatPodcast@gmail.com.
The Bebop Beat is hosted and produced by Jamie Sanchez and Lauren Fates. Our editor and associate producer is Angela Geis. Our logo and art assets are by Kat Janda.